And so it begins. This day has finally come, the day of our very first Louder Than Bombs podcast. My name is Sherry, and I'd like to thank you so much for downloading this. And basically, this show is going to be a love letter to music from comedians. We're going to talk about the music that has shaped their lives, shaped their comedy. And, you know, we'll also talk about stuff that we hate because, you know, there's some bad music out there and it deserves to be ragged on. One other thing I should tell you is that the common thread among all my guests is going to be that they have amazing taste in music. And they're also all going to be comedians, either people you've seen on television or people who write for some of the funniest shows out there, people who have amazing web series and podcasts, and also folks who do stand-up and improv. And in my humble opinion, seeing comedy live is just the best possible way to see comedy. It's that ethereal moment. It's there and then it's gone. You know what ethereal means. But to me, that just beats seeing something on television anytime. So don't just stay home and watch Office reruns or SNL. Go and support your local comedy and see some live stuff. You'll be really glad you did. Just like seeing a band live, and that's magical, same thing goes for comedy. That was my long-winded way of saying that. Anyway, without further ado, I guess we should jump right into the Matt Fisher interview portion of the podcast. I am so glad to have Matt as my first guest. He's a good friend, and even more importantly, he's one of the smartest, funniest guys out there. His sketch team, Sidecar, won the New York TV Festival 2 years running, one time for writing and one time for a pilot that they did. He was also the host of a show on ESPN called The Pretty Good Sports Show, which just amazes me because I can't believe I'm friends with someone who knows enough about sports to host a sports show on ESPN. And he's also an amazing improviser, and you can catch Matt at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater on Friday nights with his improv team, The Law Firm. If you're coming to New York, go and check out some comedy at the Upright Citizens Brigade. Don't just go to Broadway shows, because a lot of that is bullshit. A lot of that you caught when you watched Smash, which is now canceled. That just shows you how bad the state of Broadway is right now. Let's get some serious Broadway stuff going, people. What the hell's going on? Anyway, here's Matt and me. Enjoy. Oh, do you want something for your gum?
Not even. I just need to get rid of it.
Paper?
Stomach.
Are you going to swallow it?
Yeah.
7 years. You did it.
Yeah.
Oh my God, you really did. None of this is going in.
It can be. Let's talk about it. I'm an open book.
Awesome. I mean, the thing that's going to set this podcast apart from every other podcast,
sure,
every day I see another 30 of them popping up.
Right.
Is that
this one's going to be at the top of the heap.
We are.
Sure.
Because you're my good luck charm.
Oh, God. Oh, good.
Thank you.
No problem. should I generate more good luck? Do I have a reputation for being good?
You've got good mojo.
Okay.
Well,
good.
Just the way I see you,
okay,
you're,
good.
You know.
I'll stay very positive. I appreciate it.
You're a very positive person.
I'll
I want to talk about music and comedy and the connection between them, because I do feel like there is a huge connection.
Yeah.
And not just in improv, but I mean, I think that's a good starting point.
Right.
How do you see the connection between music and comedy?
I don't know. I mean, maybe just at the most basic level, like I feel like, improv, involves critical thinking. And in how closely that's related to taste, maybe, snap decisions and gut instinct. and being able to be real opinionated about music, or being able to articulate what you like or don't like about a complex idea, is important in improv. And then also, I think that leads you to love music, or to think critically about music. We were talking a little while ago about people who have listened to music, or growing up were exposed to music but never learned to think hard about what was good and what was bad. And unless you learn to do that, you also don't get very far in comedy. I think, comedy is so much about evaluating ideas. Giving the thumbs up to this and the thumbs down to that.
That's valid. There's also a rhythm to it.
That's interesting. More on the performance end.
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely.
That's
so true.
We do improv jams.
Right. That's very true. Not coincidentally.
I don't think that it is coincidentally at all.
So true. Yeah, and that collaboration of, band playing and being in sync and, communicating even, as everyone's playing together. It's just what happens in improv, isn't it?
It is. Yeah, it's that connection. It's that spiritual thing.
Yeah.
I guess it happens. It's just like there's many different paths to God.
Right.
Many different paths to that creative place, I guess you could say, right?
I wish I could bang on a musical instrument well enough to have it happen that way. I'm really jealous of music performance. And it's funny you say that, because it's been said, and I think it's really true, that every improviser wants to be in a band. That's true of me.
When you were growing up, did you play in any bands or?
No, I'm a latecomer to musical playing, like instrument proficiency. Not that I have zero proficiency, but growing up, I did every single last thing except for pick up an instrument. So it wasn't until high school that I started screwing around with the keyboard and even a little bit later with the guitar. So I can entertain myself on those things and sometimes while away the hours, looking up chords for songs. But I've never gotten a band together. That'd be great.
You should.
I should.
I've always wanted to be in a band.
Yeah. Have you ever done it? Have you ever had any experience that way?
I've tried. When I was in college, and I went to the University of Georgia in Athens, where everyone is in a band.
Sure.
Truly. I mean, I think there's...
Music town.
Music town. I think per capita, there's more bands in Athens than, maybe in Austin rivals, right?
Right.
And people would look at me and say, you look like you should be in a band.
Right.
And I had a boyfriend who was in a band. So
everyone you knew was in a band, but you walked between the raindrops.
I did. Well, what I did was I bought a Fender bass. Because in my twisted, stupid head, I thought bass is the easiest instrument to
bass. That's not so strange.
No, I just don't think it's giving bass players their due.
Well, you can be an expert at playing. You can do something, as a virtuoso. But I feel like at the level we're talking about, the level I'm at, or the level you were at the time, the road from zero bass skills to eligible bass playing is maybe the shortest road.
Yeah. Well, but my sad confession is I don't have the finger strength to really be a good bass player, And I mean, I wanted to be like Kira in Black Flag.
Right, sure.
I didn't want to be like some stupid girl who
just you don't want to
had
do
a
it
good
halfway.
Haircut. Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. So long story short, I ended up pawning the bass. And then pawning the amp. I was like, all right, here goes the bass, but I'm keeping the amp. And then went the amp. And
yeah, because why do you need an amp?
Yeah, that was the end of that.
But then you spent the money on a ticket to New York City.
Yeah, many years later. Many years and heartbreaks later did I finally make it to New York City. But I do think that a lot of comedians wish that they could be in a band.
Yeah.
It's really true.
It's that, and I know, it's funny, it's sad to say, but, for the entire time I've been doing comedy, I've always been the one who wants to, choose what people listen to in the, when they're sitting down.
Uh-huh.
That's so important to me, or, what music we come out to.
Oh, yeah.
And, I mean, that has to do with a lot of things, but I think it has to do with that thing of, because improv does not have the sex the appeal of rock and roll playing. I mean, not necessarily. I guess you can sex people down on stage.
Sure.
But in general, it's a lot more shuffling around on your feet and, looking at the floor. And so that's the closest you come is when you walk out and you're like, music is playing.
Oh, that's yeah.
Like, that's the closest improvisers come to being rock stars.
I have to agree. Like, every indie team I've been on, every class show, I've always been like, can we play the Ramones? Can we play the Replacements? Can we call ourselves something really annoying, like the Finger Pricks? I mean, it's always, I always want to do something rock and roll. And but you know what? The other thing is, like, a lot of times when you're taking improv classes, you're in with people who, like, really could give a shit about music.
Right. So frustrating. How do you talk to those people?
I don't know. I look down on them. I always, like, also envied the tech because they got to play, like, great music in between. Yeah, like,
they occupy a place of great power, man.
They really do.
This is Upright Citizens Brigade.
Yeah. At Upright Citizen, thank you. Okay. I assume that you're absolutely right.
Well, this is going to be global. This is going to be the most popular podcast where two attractive, funny people talk about something. So it's going out to people who've never even heard of the Upright Citizens.
Thank you. Right. So I'm going to back up and say we're talking about the Upright Citizens Brigade in New York, not to be confused with California, which is a whole...
God love them. It's a separate thing.
Different thing,
right?
Right
now we're talking about a theater in Chelsea that's known for... It's extremely high quality comedy,
and having like a punk rock aesthetic. I mean, and we can debate whether that's changing, but you know, I would say that was like the fundamental, right?
Yeah.
And people who started it.
The bathrooms there are pretty scary.
Yeah, they sure are. Oh my god! As a former intern, I can attest to that because I never cleaned them properly. But there was a tech. He wasn't a senior tech, but he always would play Black Eyed Peas.
I don't know the story, but I love it.
He would constantly play that song about, I don't even know the name of the song. It's like, we're going to have a party.
That's all of them.
Yeah. It's like, and then they're singing like different phrases in different languages.
Tonight's going to be a good night.
Tonight's going to be a good night. That's the.
And then they're like, Mazel Tov.
Mazel Tov. That's the one that sticks out in my mind, actually.
I think I did hear this story once. This is a good story.
Yeah. So this guy, like every single time he teched, he would play that song.
Yeah.
And finally, the artistic director actually took him aside and said,
yeah, this is not a Black Eyed Peas
kind of
Institute.
Place. Right. You can't do that here, you know. When we sat down, you started telling me that you sort of came late to like the musical taste party.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, maybe it's just relative to my wife. So my wife has all these great stories about how, like, because we were both born in 1979. And that's just to give you a perspective on the fact that, like, she'll talk about how, like, her mom and her listening to, like, Cyndi Lauper or things like that, or, like, you know, music that was popular at the time. And my parents were not engaged in the current scene as I was growing up. Thank God, because, and I'm sure we'll talk about my all-time favorite recording artist is Willie Nelson, and my parents definitely gave me that.
That's awesome.
So I have no complaints, but... I wasn't plugged into what was actually going on until like eighth grade, high school, things like that. I got a Discman in eighth grade and the first CD I got was the Beauty and the Beast soundtrack. And then the first like popular music CDs I got were MC Hammer and Vanilla Ice. And that's like a little bit, that's kind of involving critical thinking, but not very much. And a guy who I went to school with, Scott Olette, he had CDs, and he lent me two CDs. He lent me Automatic for the People, which would be a first ballot Desert Island disc for me.
Awesome.
And I was like, I played the first track on that drive, and I was like, I don't listen to country music. Gave it back to him. And then he gave me Black Sheep, which was great. Black Sheep was this duo, this like hip-hop duo, their big song. They had a song... The Choice is Yours. And it wasn't until like in high school and I started listening to like They Might Be Giants and like it was like Pearl Jam and then like that was then it got in and then I started making more intelligent choices.
But so what was your first concert?
My first concert, well, as a toddler, I was brought to like some John Denver joints. I feel like I might have seen Harry Chapin when I was a wee babe. But then my first, like, legit concert was my cousin Lori brought me to see Debbie Gibson.
Oh.
Electric Youth 87 at Lake Compounds in Connecticut. I was big into Debbie Gibson at the time, and we didn't have cable. So I would constantly sneak over to my friend's house and, like, just force him to, like, turn on MTV and just sit there in hopes that, like – and then, like I said, I had no musical you know, vocabulary at all. So it'd just be like a lot of stuff that made no sense. And I was like, if you see the Electric Youth video, just tape it or something, because I can't be at your house all the time.
Crush on her?
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
It was, that was the entree there.
I would think so.
Well, at the time, she was the youngest person to ever write, produce, and record, and like perform on a number one hit single.
I actually remember that.
And that was like a thing at the time.
Yeah, yeah. Like, she wasn't like Tiffany.
Right.
Well, who was her big rival.
That was like the first like tectonic thing of like Debbie Gibson versus Tiffany.
And, yeah.
Tiffany struck me as a little bit cheap.
I think we're alone now. Like,
I'm like, that was like a cover. It's like, why?
Tommy James and the Shondells. Like,
that did not need updating.
No.
And here Debbie Gibson is writing all these songs. Yeah. I don't know.
I agree.
I'm friends with a lot of Tiffany people, but I can't.
No.
I can't go there. Really. Trying to get away into the night, and then
you put your arms around me, and we tumble to the ground. John Denver, though, that's, I mean, that kind of. In my mind, sure. I'm thinking, all right, country.
Right.
That kind of like sets a foundation. And, you know, my mom loves John Denver. Mm. Moms love John Denver.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. There's like that holy trinity. It's like John Denver, Neil Diamond, yeah. and Andrea Bocelli, I think. When you say yeah, that's sort yeah, of yeah, like, yeah. that's where they go.
It was like from the Rockies, from Israel, and from Italy. That's where the global
yeah, mom. Exactly. I remember when I was a kid, my mom would go to like Neil Diamond shows. Like my parents, anytime he blew into Miami, my parents went. And there was like a Times, like Time magazine, not New York Times. Time did a like cover story on him or
sure,
something.
Yeah.
And he talked about how he'd smoked pot.
Oh, no.
And, like, in my parents' mind, that was, like, mind-blowing. Like, they couldn't imagine that Neil Diamond had ever smoked pot.
Well, that's, and I think that was the same thing with my parents and John Denver was, like, it was good music, it was quality music, but it didn't really carry that whiff of rebellion. Like, I'm sure John Denver smoked a certain amount of pot in his day, but, like, that didn't really come out in the music. The music was all pretty straight arrow type stuff.
Well, Rocky Mountain High, though.
Rocky Mountain High. Nerarica, one of his good songs, what's it called? Poems, Prayers, and Promises does make reference to passing a pipe around. But it's so positive. The whole thing is so positive. Like, you can't imagine him, like, spray painting the side of a subway.
So, country music.
Yeah.
That is, like, your... And, I mean, R.E.M.
Right. Yeah, that's part of the DNA, definitely.
Yeah.
And that's that first thing when I listened to Drive, when I accidentally rejected R.E.M., I was like, oh, I don't listen to country music. But yeah, that's yeah. It, well, they have a lot of influences, but they are a musical band. Like, the way they always wrote music was, like, the music was one thing, and then they would hand it in, essentially, to Michael Stipe, and he would write lyrics. And so there is something about, like, insular guitar guys just, like, sitting alone and trying to, like, write, you know, like chord, you know, like bang out some chord stuff, and you hear that in the music, and I feel like that's kind of a country thing.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. There's something, I guess there is something in that sort of like we're a bar band.
Mm.
There's no pretense. I mean, Michael Stipe brought that art layer, even though I guess they were all art school dropouts.
Right.
But
he carried that flag.
Yeah, I mean, I remember that there was like this big controversy when they got really big and he wanted to move to New York and everyone else was really happy staying in Athens.
Right,
you know,
right.
I mean, that just kind of says it all, right?
Right?
You know, he was friends with Bono.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
He had arrived in the world and they were like, oh, let's just hang out. Like, we're all like college, like, let's play college rock and do that thing.
Exactly. This is a complete aside,
sure.
But I'm wondering, are you watching Nashville?
I'm not watching Nashville.
Oh.
Am I missing out?
You need to watch that show. It's really good.
Yeah?
It's, well, I'm just thinking that you,
especially would probably dig it.
Really?
Yeah. It's a very, very well done show. And you know who the music consultant is for that show?
No.
T-Bone Burnett.
Oh, nice.
He does all their music selections.
Oh, that's awesome. I did not know that.
So, you know, and I mean, there's lots of layers to that show. And there's like, so there's like a teeny bopper kind of like country, like a, I guess like a Taylor Swift type of knockoff. And he picks perfect songs for her. But then he also picks like real kind of like songs of depth and soul for, you know, for the really tortured characters, I guess is the best. I don't want to give too much away, but.
It's funny you mentioned T-Bone Burnett. He's good at that. Like, I feel like he is so, his roots go so deep, but then he's also gets involved in like, you know, things that could be cheap, but aren't. But like, he lends a real air of respectability to some great things.
Yeah.
One album that I listened to a bunch a couple of years ago was, the soundtrack to Crazy Heart. Remember the movie Crazy Heart?
I do remember Crazy Heart.
It was this Jeff Bridges movie, and it was about like kind of like a broken down country singer. It was written by a guy who had studied Waylon Jennings, but didn't get the rights really to make a movie about Waylon Jennings. So he made this like fictionalized movie that, you know, you could recognize some of that. And there are great stories about, because like the soundtrack album is all Jeff Bridges
singing.
And Jeff Bridges can play, and like he has like a band. But in that thing, like they discussed like Waylon Jennings, how do you want this music to sound? And damn, some of those songs aren't like just don't hold up. Like they're pretty good. Like that soundtrack album is pretty good.
That is good to know, and I don't doubt it. I have actually downloaded a bunch of songs from Nashville.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
I know. It's like it's one of those
He's
things.
He's good. Like he can. T-Bone Burnett is like, because he was involved in what is it? Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Yeah, he was.
Did all that stuff too.
Yeah.
I feel like if you have a project that could go both ways, that could go either way in terms of legit music pedigree, T-Bone Burnett will pull your ass out of the fire.
He'll sort you out.
Yeah, he'll sort you out.
That's good advice. Seriously, I'm going to have to send you some songs now, and you're going to have to tell me whether I've gone bananas.
So.
You know, maybe like, because you know how sometimes you think something's good, like at home,
right.
You're like, this is good. And then maybe someone else hears it and goes, what were you?
Well, that's
thinking?
How most of my taste is that way. Like, I would not like to have a lot of the music I listen to interrogated by others or audited.
Do you ever worry about something that comes up on your iPod?
Oh, yeah. I think a lot about how, because I use earbud headphones on the subway, and I'm always like, how far away is this audible?
What's like?
Who knows what's going on in here?
What would you say is the most embarrassing thing on your iPod? I always wonder about that with people.
I don't know. Well, definitely the most unrelatable. The thing that people would look most quizzically at me about is on my iPod. So I collect the music that plays at Disney World in different contexts. So like on rides, within rides, also just ambient music that sort of plays in the parks.
Really?
And then also like announcements that you might hear or the, you know, the spiel on the monorail as you go from place to place. And I have days and days worth of that music. And so I think a lot of people would have a hard time sympathizing with my enthusiasm for that.
That's actually, like, if I saw that, I'd be like, this is either the coolest person or a terrifying person.
Yo, man, welcome.
Depending.
That's the ABC's Matt Fisher.
like a John Wayne Gacy.
You just wrote my tombstone.
It's a small world. That's probably the easiest one to get.
Well, there's different versions. I mean, there's like, you know, there have been several soundtrack albums published by the parks that you can get as like a souvenir. And there are a couple different versions from those. But then there's also people do incredible work of cutting together. Like it must be based on some sort of Disney special they made to promote It's a Small World. But there, I do have a very long, probably 12 or 15 minute long ride through version of It's a Small World, where the actual appeal of It's a Small World is that all these people are singing the same song, but as you float through the different areas of the world, it's like in the sort of the local vernacular. So if when you're in Scotland, it's a bunch of pipers and all that stuff. And I have one version that kind of incorporates all those different tracks and sort of a simulation of what the ride is like.
It's amazing.
It's great.
I have to tell you, one of my big childhood traumas happened to me at the It's a Small World.
Really? Stuck on it?
No, actually. When I was a kid, I used to go to Disney World every weekend because my dad ran a hotel that was like right outside of Disney World.
Cool.
And we'd have to go and spend the weekend with him. So I went a lot.
Right.
And, you know.
And it's easy for him to say like, hey, Disney World.
Disney, right? Yeah.
Come on.
What kid isn't going to love that?
Sure.
So I, and that was my favorite ride because I was a wimp and I was mesmerized.
No, you know what though? People, I'll defend that. People get cynical about It's a Small World. And I think it's because it makes them uncomfortable to hear a prayer for peace spoken with the innocence of children. But go ahead.
Yeah. So my dad took me on the ride and I was holding his hand. At some point, I looked up. I realized it wasn't his hand.
Yeah, that's classic.
There was just some strange man.
Was he anywhere in the boat?
this was like waiting to get on the boat.
Okay. Because that's on him. If he put you on a boat with another family, that's his problem.
Oh, but it's still very upsetting when you're like
stressful.
A little kid and you look up and there's like some strange man holding your hand.
Oh, definitely.
It's not good.
That's not right.
Yeah, I'm getting chills from it.
Sure.
Like I'm reliving it right now. It's like my own personal touch of evil.
Does that happen at the end of Touch of Evil?
Yes.
It
plays that way in my mind. It's in black and white.
That's Touch of Evil.
When I'm at a show, I mean, I do, I am like a head bobber.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a head bobber, for sure. But I can't stand some asshole who just has to, like, you know,
draw
do a
attention.
Whirling dervish
draw
thing.
Focus.
Or
yeah,
I mean, it's like, come on, it's so unnecessary. And then, and the whole mosh pit thing, too, also. It's like, there came a time when mosh pits happened at shows that had nothing to do with, I mean, like,
right.
You know what I mean? Like,
right.
It would be like, air,
yeah.
And there'd be like a mosh pit. You know,
little slow mo mosh pit.
Yeah, like,
very gentle pushing.
I could get behind that one. Actually,
that might be fun. Has anybody ever done it that way? Sort of like an affectionate mosh pit.
Yeah, more like a. It's like a performance art thing. I wanted to go back to the country music thing.
Sure.
Because I know it's a very big thing to you.
Yeah.
And since we started talking about doing this, I've sort of like, I've been exposing myself more.
Nice. To children? Or
to anyone.
Oh, cool.
Lonely times.
But hey, whatever gets you through the
I was telling you, I like Patsy Cline. Like,
yeah.
I mean, she's like a lifelong love of mine. And I like Johnny Cash. And that's pretty much where I drew the line. Although I did realize that one of my all-time favorite songs is a country song. Strictly speaking.
Sure.
Wichita Lineman.
Yeah.
Great song.
Yeah, definitely.
Do you like that song?
Yeah, I definitely like that song.
Okay, because I kind of judge people by whether they appreciate that song or not.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, you're right to describe it that way because it's definitely a country song, but has its feet in the time in which it came out, definitely.
Absolutely.
It being about a guy who works on telephone poles.
Yeah.
And then also, like, that sort of, I guess it's a guitar line where it sounds like Morse code.
Yes.
Kind of like, it's like so like otherworldly kind of. I really
it's
like
genius.
That. Yeah.
I've always enjoyed it and I always get like that. You know, there's certain songs that kind of give you like that feeling where you get that little lump in the back of your throat and you're like, I feel so alone.
Yeah.
And that song always takes me to that like lonely place.
Yeah.
And I looked up today, I Wikipedia'd it.
Sure.
And when it was Glen Campbell, but it's been covered a bunch of times.
Oh, yeah.
REM covered it actually, which is kind of cool. But it was described as the first existential country song. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I'd take that. Definitely true of that song. Like that's definitely like a lonely, kind of like, you know, head down working kind of song.
Yeah, he's on the poles. And he's thinking about his love, and there's this Morse code thing happening, and she obviously doesn't want him, and the despair. It's just great.
Country music makes no pretension to, not complexity, but certainly like obfuscation of.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, I know you know the song already, but that's why I sent you that song, Ruby, Don't Take Your Love to Town, which is another song that I've always really adored.
Yep.
And really, I mean, it's just so, I mean, that whole story is just like right there. Vietnam vet, lost his legs, his wife and or girl, I don't know.
She's begging her to not go out and sleep with other people. Yeah.
But it's great.
Yeah. And it's like plain on its face, and you know, it doesn't hide behind complexity, you know, it's just the chords and the lyrics.
There's no metaphor in that song.
But it's so heartbreaking. I mean, that's what they talk about how, you know, some music requires more skill or this or that. Country music isn't complex in that way that it's hard to play, but it's got to be so hard to make music that's that like heart-wrenching, but still so plain.
Don't take your love to town. What do you think of Jack White or the White Stripes?
I like him. I like his music. I like him more when I hear what he likes, or like, because especially in the White Stripes, I love their albums and I love a lot of their songs, but it's always hard to tease apart like what's a pose and what wasn't. I feel like Jack White is becoming more comfortable in his own skin a little bit, and there's less like kind of like hiding behind the t-shirts and more. So like, I think I like him more as time goes on. To answer your question,
I can agree with that. I mean, I definitely have always felt like his heart was in the right place. Like, he had good taste and everything. Right. But, like, he's another one that I could kind of throw, like, into the Michael Stipe camp, where there was, like, a lot of pretentious...
A lot of smoke.
Yeah, you know, like, you know, I want to be a rock star kind of thing.
What was the name? There was a great documentary about guitar players.
Oh, yeah. And he was featured in it.
He was featured in it, but like...
Jimmy Page and
Edge and him.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody else. And, but like everyone else, and the Edge was the most... He was like, yeah, man, this is this wall of stuff that I plug the guitar into. And I play this one thing, and then it sounds like a U2 song. He was like, they completely stripped the mask away. And Jack White was exactly the opposite. He was like... He had this like little black boy who always needed to stand by him.
Oh God!
And I think he referred to that as like him in the future, or like him as a boy. And it was like people just want to hear about like the effects pedals. Like people just want to like know like how did you write "Fell in Love with a Girl"?
I can really respect him as a musician.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'd probably want to punch him in the face if I knew him. Like I'd probably want to give him a good punch in the face.
Definitely. And, well, he has his new album and he travels with an all-girl band.
Yeah, I know.
And it's like, all the songs are good. Like, you don't have to be so weird.
Yeah.
You know, like, you can... And he has... I feel like he... Because he loves old music.
Yeah.
Like, and he's, like, so well-versed in, you know, he knows exactly what he's talking about. He could be a very honest guy. Like, he could be much more plain about it. And I think seem way cooler.
Yeah. I think somewhere along the line, he kind of has like a Michael Jackson problem where he just doesn't want to relate with people or something. You know what I mean? He's like the Michael Jackson of like indie rock or something. I'm just going to say that. It feels
yeah,
real.
I get exactly what you're talking about.
It feels very
feels
real.
Very right, yeah.
Right? But anyway, so he, I guess some record store in, I think it's in Memphis or Nashville.
Yeah, that's what he's... I don't know the
Third
town.
Man Records.
Right, that's his record,
label.
And they have like these weird experiments.
Yeah, and they installed one of those cool like, you know, record booths where you could just go in and make your own little 45.
Yeah, onto vinyl.
On vinyl. Wouldn't that
nice.
Be awesome?
Yeah.
Oh my God, that would just be amazing. But anyway, so he recorded Coal Miner's Daughter.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was like, I like it, but at the same, I still want to punch him in the face. Like... Do you know what I mean? That was like my feeling. Like, I like it, but I feel like there's
like, you're still being that way.
Yeah, you're still that way. Let's not pretend that you're not being that. Yeah.
Well, they always did a great version of Jolene, too. Like,
it's
that same thing where you're like, oh, it's so good, but are you a big dick? Like are you being a big dick?
Yeah.
Like, but the song is so great. Musically, it's so cool.
Totally. I know.
We just can't believe that one guy could be that cool.
He's super talented.
Very talented.
Very talented. And I saw the White Stripes play like at least half a dozen times.
Oh, yeah?
Like
I've never seen them live.
Oh, amazing band live.
Yeah.
I saw them at Radio City with the Strokes.
Oh, nice.
Two nights they did. And then they did like a surprise show like in Union Square one day. They just popped up at Union Square and they did a show.
That's cool.
And someone tipped me off and like I pretended I had a stomach ache and left work.
Sure.
And but here's the thing. I always got the feeling, and I love Meg White. I think she's what made the White Stripes amazing.
Oh, for sure.
You know, she gave them that little bit of homemade.
Right. Jack White hasn't been back to that level.
No.
You know, so it's easy to laugh up your sleeve about Meg White, but that was not a, that was no accident that that band happened the way it did.
Exactly. True. But I always got the feeling that every night she went home and cried. I always got the feeling that there was just some kind of mind fuck situation going on there. Didn't he, like, is it just me? Like, I always got this impression that she was, like, in love with him still. Because, you know, they were obviously married, even though there was that whole brother-sister bullshit. Right. In love with him still, and he was like, let's just keep the band together.
Well, I think, you know, I don't even, I can't get that far into her head, but I just sympathize with the fact that, like, you're always going to be the boring one. Like if it's you and Jack White, like, no one feels compelled to act that way except for him. And so, you know, like, people got on her for being so vanilla and, like, you know, the way she played and all this other stuff. And it's like, well, obviously there's no more air in the room, you know, like, obviously there's no, you know, and, you know, I, and, you know, talking about comedy too, like, I respect those people who just want to go out on stage and keep it all held down, you know, and keep the show together. The show needs that.
Yeah.
And, you know, she did everything that was required of her and more in that band. It was a great, great band. But, you know, like, you're always going to be the person on stage who's not Jack White, you know?
True. And maybe that's all I felt. I want to give her that much credit. I want to think that Meg White is happy somewhere now. Like, I want to think that she's back in Minneapolis. Detroit, right? They're from Detroit.
They are two from Detroit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, somewhere in that nebulous Midwest region that I don't know. But, yes, I want to think she's back in Detroit and she's happy.
Right.
Can we give her that?
Yeah. God, I hope. She deserves it.
She does. She deserves it.
The songs are good. And, you know, people say that her playing was so vanilla, but even just on Fell in Love with a Girl, they're so, like the drum hit that opens that song and then punctuates it now and then is like feathered in such a way that, like, I think her playing, this sounds so stupid to say, but I think it was, like, deceptively good. You know, like, she's not all over the road like him and the guitar.
No.
But, like, I think she was very canny in the way she played. And I think that that band would not have survived two people playing their instruments like Jack White was playing his instrument.
I totally agree. I mean, I've always kind of thought, not just because she's a female drummer, but I've always kind of thought of her in the same vein as, like, a Mo Tucker.
Mm.
Where, like, there was something kind of, like, half a beat behind, I guess you could say. I mean, I'm not a musician, so I don't know if it was a full half beat behind or whatever. She was always kind of, like, a little bit behind what he was doing.
Right.
But it gave it its...
Yeah, that's where the jazz was.
Yeah, like, it gave
that,
it
that
its...
That's the sound. Yeah.
That's the sound. Yeah. You know, if it was... like, if he had hired a drummer that was as proficient as him, it would just sound like just, I don't know, like Rush or Yes.
That's true. She would have needed a much bigger kit to play drums like he played guitar.
Exactly.
I don't even know if I would say she was behind so much as she was just, like, on point. Like, she was the one, like, playing a little, like, who could hear the metronome a little bit, you know?
You know, it just always felt like, I don't know, like, I always, you know, I flatter myself because I have no rhythm whatsoever, but I always flatter myself to think, you know what, if I'd taken a week and just really, like, practice hitting, like, a bass drum, you know, I could probably fill in for her on an off night, okay?
Detroit, she just heard that. She's like, oh, I'm not happy anymore. I had it all. I was in a pretty centered emotional place, and Orange just blew me up.
No, I mean that, like, it would be a bad show. Like, people would go home and say, what was wrong with Meg White that night?
Right.
You know, like, she looked Persian.
No. I want my money back. There's a lot. I've been led to believe a lot of things that weren't true.
This wasn't the right thing. But I'm just saying, like, there's something in not being so proficient that made them great.
Sure, sure.
It really did.
Yeah. Jolene, Jolene, Jolene,
Jolene. I'm begging of you, please don't take my man. I have to tell you, like, I went to the University of Georgia because I was a big REM fan.
Was that part of it?
It was.
That's amazing.
It was.
That's awesome.
I wanted to study film, and then I saw that they only had a journalism department.
Like, it's okay, man.
I was like, it's all right.
Surprise,
surprise.
Did it pay off in any tangible way? Like, did you, like, you must have gone to, like, 40 Watt and stuff.
Oh, my God. I painted the 40 Watt.
Oh, yeah?
I did. Like, I was friends with them, and they actually, like, called me one day and were like, all the beer you can drink, just come and help us paint.
No way.
Yeah. That's so cool. Yeah, it was, at the time, it was owned by Peter Buck's wife,
right, yeah.
Barry.
Yeah.
I think they've broken up since, but
that's my understanding.
She was one of the partners, and yeah, I was a total regular there, so...
That's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So Athens is great.
Yeah.
And I saw REM play in many different versions and places and yeah. Saw them play with Fugazi and Billy Bragg and I mean, you know,
like all bands, they do.
Everyone who blew into Billy town Bragg. Would yeah. kind of like get them to like jump on stage, you know, like it was a pretty cool thing.
Lend their endorsement.
Absolutely. Yeah. And actually like I shouldn't even say this because he's probably going to be listening to this and he'll be like, oh, she still thinks of me. And I don't still think of you, except for right now.
Get over it. Person about to be announced. <Yeah.
laughs> But anyway, my boyfriend at the time was in a band that Michael Stipe produced.
Oh, cool.
And sang backup on one of their tracks.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, this band called Daisy.
Yeah. That's one of the things I like about REM is you always hear of them trying to give back, especially now that they're not, you know, like together.
Yeah.
Like the way they're always like producing albums and like trying to bring up people and, you know, even just through like the way I experience it is like just on like Facebook, like they're not a going concern anymore, but they're always like linking up like some guy or something, you know, they know and like trying to promote other music. It's like so great.
That's great. And yeah. It's like a small town mentality. It's like you should never lose that. It's a good thing, really right? True. It's a good thing. I designed a game, and I gave you a hint about this.
Yeah, I know.
I gave you.
I don't know how well I'll do. I don't really know the rules of the game, but I'm excited to play an REM themed game.
But so you're familiar with their earlier stuff too,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, because to me, like, I'm a purist, and like, even though I like their stuff after they went major label,
sure.
I'm an IRS.
Sure.
I mean, like, that's the good stuff, right?
Right.
That's the pure stuff.
Right.
And like, you do know that Michael Stipe, his first few gigs, apparently, he didn't even face the audience. He did it with his back to the
right,
audience. It was
right.
a stage fright thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that maybe was one of the reasons why the lyrics were so difficult to discern. I think
that's definitely is that he didn't care to be understood.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh,
but
for sure.
I think even like I'm going to give him credit here and say that it's from a shyness perspective, maybe.
Right.
As opposed to like,
audience contempt.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Which, you know, is possible with some people.
Oh, definitely.
Right?
Oh, definitely.
Like, you know, you could want to. Audience contempt is a very easy thing to have.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. Oh, no. I definitely credit him for wanting to do something personal beyond his ability to, like, be comfortable sharing with others. I definitely. That's how I read it, definitely.
Awesome. Okay. So.
Oh, God. Did I just raise the difficulty level of the game?
Yeah, you did.
Oh, no.
Wait, and also, just as an aside, what's your favorite album? Just wondering.
I think that, I mean, you're an IRS person, so I don't want to get into it.
Obviously,
I do want to get into it, but...
yeah, don't get into it. That's why we're recording.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, and you know, if this is the first, this is a young podcast.
Yeah.
So let me just say that this is a problem you're gonna wrestle with every day that you record this podcast is the space between what I think is the best and what I prefer.
Okay.
Because like definitely the one closest to my heart is Automatically the People.
Great.
And I know that doesn't distinguish me. And I know I know Everybody Hurts is on there. I know it had all the videos. But it's like it hit me at that time. And
yeah.
By God, it's a great album.
Sure, it is. Even I think it's a great album. I'm not going to judge that.
In terms of like the straight up best, like I would say like Chronic Town. Like in terms of like being distinctive and also like true to like what they were trying to do. And, you know, obviously they explored a lot of great avenues and they found great, great places. And I'll defend Monster till the day I die.
I love Monster.
Till the day I die.
It's a great album.
It is a... You're agreeing with me. I'm not going to yell at you.
I'm not going to yell at you because
you're agreeing with me. So
yeah,
I'm not,
yeah.
Why would I get angry?
I'll give it to him.
But yeah, I mean, you know, it's certainly Chronic Town being the most... I don't know, distinctive isn't the right word, but like if you wanted to hear what they were up to... Or hear, you know, what they sound like left to their own devices. That's got to be it.
I would agree. I mean, I would say that I probably listened to Chronic Town, like, just on repeat.
Yeah.
Like, a million times, and every time found something new to, like, astound me.
Oh, yeah.
And speaking of that, speaking of bass, I actually believe that Mike Mills is what makes them so distinct.
Oh, yeah.
Because he does all these little flourishes that, like, you sometimes only barely hear, but they just, like, you know, he goes above and beyond.
Those bass lines are so clean, and so, you know, you talk about country music, and they obviously have a lot of country DNA, but part of it is it's through him and through the bass where, you know, the guitar lines, especially early on, were very complex.
Yep.
And very, you know, staccato. But all the way through, like, his articulation of, like, sort of, like, the backbone of the song was always, you know, I think that's what led them to pop appeal and, you know, and also the harmonies.
Oh, yeah.
Especially later on when you checked out. Sure, super cool. but like, you know, his harmonies, you know, which, you know, obviously, like, they talk about the Beach Boys and stuff like that all the time. But, you know, like Willie Nelson, his sound owes so much to, what's his name, Mickey Raphael, the harmonica player.
Oh.
And in that same way, you know, R.E.M. and Mike Mills singing and playing bass is, you know, it's not up front, but it's, like, I think maybe the most important.
I don't know why I'm surprised, because you're such a bright person, but, like, you just went up way
bright,
way
bright enough to agree with you,
yeah. No, but it's true. In that vein, I have selected a bunch of REM songs that, and I don't know if this is going to be good or not, so we might just do a couple and just say this was a stupid idea.
Cool.
But these are favorite songs of mine.
Okay.
However, I don't know what the fuck he's saying.
Sure.
And I do that thing. I don't know if you do this thing when you're listening to REM. I'll do that thing where I'll kind of be like,
tough
waste
to
of time, sitting still, I can hear you. I do that.
Yeah.
So here's some, and I gave you paper and pen in case you want to try.
Okay. What am I going to try to do?
To write down what you think he's saying. Yeah. And I have the lyrics.
Okay, good.
Printed out so we can actually see what he's saying. And, like, we can start with let's start with something from Chronic Town, actually. We can do Gardening at Night.
Okay, good.
It's a little bit of Gardening at Night. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
I can play for you again.
No, I got it.
Did you really? Because I think I got half of that. Okay, I want to hear. I really want to hear what you say.
I see your money on the floor.
Oh.
I felt your pocket change. Something else. something. And as I broke through the door, it just didn't seem to be to something.
Oh, my God. I think you're right. I think you just got 80% of Gardening at Night. The first part of Gardening at Night. I am blown away because I always thought he said something like, I'm sitting on the floor, I felt your pocket change, something.
Yeah.
That's all I ever really got. And then I just got excited because I knew that the chorus would be around in about 20 seconds. But okay, according to...
Because there's also something about where looking up the lyrics. I remember because they one of the last things they put out was like this live concert thing. I think it was live in Dublin.
Huh.
And they played a bunch of old songs, and he went to those sites to like like get the lyrics so that he could. And he read off like
a no.
But then like the lyrics, he was like these aren't the lyrics. Like he would be reading. And then in between songs, he's like, I looked this up on the internet so I could, like, remind myself of what the book is. And these aren't even close.
Oh, no. Well, that just blows my mind. Someone has to have the music publishing rights on these, don't they?
Is that true? Like, would Michael Sipe once upon a time in 1980 have to admit to a lawyer somewhere, like, what the lyrics were so that they could be legally protected?
According to Nashville, which I've been watching, yes. Yes.
Interesting.
But I could be wrong because I'm getting all my information off of an ABC.
Well, I mean, you're citing a source. I'm not.
So
yeah. I trust you.
All right. I see your money on the floor. I felt the pocket change through all.
Through all. That's a tough part, but
the feelings that broke through the door just didn't seem to be too real.
I didn't do too bad.
You didn't.
I didn't do real bad.
You didn't. I'm very impressed.
Thank you. In tune with the REM thing.
Amazed. Okay, we're going to try one more.
Okay, good.
Because I'm amazed. Sure. God, all right. All right.
I have really good hearing.
Yeah, you do. Well, more than that. Okay, how about something off of Murmur?
Okay, good.
Okay. Sitting Still. Okay. I mentioned that song before.
Tough.
That's a tough one. And it's actually one of my favorite REM songs. I'm going to be amazed if you get half of this, actually.
I will too.
I know this is about his childhood.
Do you?
He introduced it that way when I saw them play at the Fox Theater in Atlanta.
Oh, nice. See, I never saw him in Georgia.
That's
in Hartford, it's a whole other thing. Okay. Earth Defy Acadia. Good. That's a bad sign. You're laughing. That's good. By a kitchen-sized, and then it gets tough, but not something. Sitting, trifle, just begin. Wasting time, sitting.
Okay, and I always thought that it's something about candy bars. He's saying, out to find candy bars. Something kitchen-sized.
Kitchen-sized, we agree on.
Yeah, but not something.
Sure.
Something, 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 something.
Yeah.
Waste of time sitting still.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I think he's saying.
So you heard this thing in Atlanta and it colored your whole
I don't know.
Understanding.
I thought because he was a kid he was talking about candy bars.
I buy that.
But
it's not a bad theory. I have no, why would he be talking about Acadia?
Well, you know what? Up to par and candy bars. The kitchen signs, but not me in. Set a trap for love, big kill. Don't waste your time sitting still. We both got that wrong.
Yeah, we both burnt it. Can I say, may I suggest, that that song is harder to understand if you knew the lyrics. Like, that makes, it's weird to say, but that song makes more sense if you don't understand what it's saying.
Yeah.
That's very hard to track what the sentiment of those words are.
Yeah, up to par. I don't know. Well, good work. Good try. Let's do one last one. And okay. Then, well, is it too easy? Do you know what's the frequency, Kenneth?
I'll do pretty well, I think.
I probably will. Let's give you an easy one then.
Sure.
The other one was going to be, I was going to do something from Fall on Me or something from South Central Rain. You can pick.
Let's do Fall on Me because it's like harder. It's not obvious.
Okay.
I haven't read the published lyrics, but it's not like... I've felt the sting of embarrassment here. I've gone off the road once. Like, let's have one where we could have a win.
Wait, but before we start, do you know what Fall on Me is about? This I know.
I don't think I know.
It's about acid rain.
Sure. That's true to the period. Good.
Great album. Life's Rich Pageant.
Yeah.
And by the way, my favorite REM album is Fables of the Reconstruction.
Interesting. Why?
Because it is kind of dark and gloomy and reminds me of, I was living in London when I really, really, really got into it.
Mm.
And then I found out that they recorded it in London.
Oh, cool.
And it kind of has that living in dreary conditions kind of feeling to it.
It definitely hangs together. It has that mood, but it's also stylistically kind of a departure. There are a lot of songs on there like, there's no other REM song like Wendell G. There's no other REM song like Green Girl of the Rushes. They'll throw you Driver 8. You know, if you're by God, you got to play some on the radio.
Yeah,
play Driver 8.
That was their single.
Yep.
But all right. Anyway, so we're going with Fall on Me. Are you ready?
Yes.
Okay. Pens at the ready. What do you think he's saying?
Okay, here we go. There's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Feathers, iron. Bargain buildings, weights and pulleys. Feathers hit the ground before their weight can leave the air.
I think you have that. I think you have it. I think feathers is the part that I have never in my mind, like, it's never registered in my mind that he would say feathers, weights, and pulleys. Right.
It's a left turn in terms of words.
It's a stipend. I was gonna call this game It's a Man Ray Kind of Sky.
Sure.
Because for so long, I was like, I think he's saying It's a Man Ray Kind of Sky, but who says?
Yeah. I remember I visited Paris one time, and we went to, God, what's the name of that? It's an incredible modern art gallery. I forget the name. It's a French name. And they had some of Man Ray's photographs, or like a film, maybe even like a little film installation.
Wow.
And I made that connection. It was like, oh God, Man Ray. And I was like, that doesn't look anything like any sky. But it was a great moment of synchronicity.
Yeah.
So what's your reading? Give me your on falling.
I think he's saying there's a problem, something, something, mm-hmm. bargain buildings, weights and pulleys, mm-hmm. something, something, something before the weight can leave the air.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I think he's saying.
Okay,
there's a lot of somethings in there.
There's
I
a little
think
bit
it's
of
feathers,
but that's fair.
All right,
you
let's
earn it.
Yeah, we'll see. I think you got it. Oh my God, you do.
Oh man,
there's a problem. Feathers, iron.
Oh my.
Bargain buildings, weights and pulleys. Feathers hit the ground before the weight can leave the air. You got that 100%.
Well,
that was an A.
I'll cop to this. I did say feathers hit the ground before their weight can leave the air.
Oh,
but
that's a tip.
We're talking high 90s. I mean, I'm proud of what I did. I'll say that.
You got into the brown of R.E.M. lyrics. I have to give you that. That's that. I mean, like, hats
some
off.
Brown level work.
That's brown level academia right there. I'm going to ask you just a couple questions that I'm going to ask every guest.
Oh,
as
cool.
A way. It's
oh,
sort
nice.
Of like our Inside
this
the Actor's
show is
Studio.
Legit.
Yeah, it's so
we've
legit.
We've got a whole system.
But we're trying it out, you know, okay?
Okay.
All right. Here's a thinker. Kinks or who?
Kinks. Big into the Kinks. And you know what? It's that country music thing of I feel like they accomplished more and kept it simple.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they didn't get as operatic, but man, they didn't really have bad songs, and yeah, I really like them.
I'm with you. I shouldn't give that away, but yeah, I would say Kinks also. Although I do have an appreciation. I just recently watched Quadrophenia for the first time in like a few years.
Yeah, yeah.
And I, for some reason, had like a whole new level of appreciation for it.
Interesting.
So
it's been a long time since I've seen Quadrophenia.
You should check it out. You should check it out. Also, there's a really good documentary about Quadrophenia and how it was sort of like through the lens of a band that once had been mod but had moved on, and it's like a rock opera.
Right.
And just like looking at it from that perspective, I think kind of like made me look at it in this like new way.
Hmm.
It's on Crackle, if you have
nice.
Crackle.
Cool.
Yeah. Favorite TV theme song?
Mr. Belvedere.
Are you just being controversial?
No, zero controversy.
I don't remember Mr. Belvedere.
It's Leon Redbone.
Oh, okay.
And the lyrics are not super easy to understand, but they tell the story of the arrival and effect of Mr. Belvedere on that family in a kind of elliptical way.
Uh-huh.
And it's great. I mean, when you asked, I was going to say Cheers, but here's why you can't say Cheers. And if someone later says Cheers, don't publish their episode.
This okay.
Because there are other verses to that song.
Oh, yeah.
And the other verses are terrible. Are terrible.
I've heard them. And you're right. They really
They're
took
crazy.
The cream of the crop and used
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah. They cobbled together 30 seconds of musical tape. It's like, there's like, your husband wants to be, your ex-husband
yeah.
wants to be a girl. And it's like your therapist ran away. It's like, oh, you were all over the map. Gary Portnoy.
Oh, all right. I'm gonna look up this Mr. Belvedere gem.
I can just give it to you.
Yeah, send it over.
Okay.
According to our new arrival, life is more than mere survival. We just might live the good life yet.
Final question. What album or band would you recommend just, you know, as something that might broaden someone's music vocabulary a little?
Something I don't think people might have listened to?
Yeah, maybe something semi-obscure, a little off the beaten track. It doesn't have to be, like, crazy.
All right, well, here, I'll say this, and this is, depending on the track you're on, this might not be too far off the beat track, but it, as a proportion of celebrated by society to how much I love it, is very either high or low, whichever's in the good way. There's this guy named Robin Thicke. And we've spoken about him a little bit.
We have.
And listen, this is, and none of what I'm about to say is an apology. Some context is required. Robin Thicke is the son of Alan Thicke,
who, yep.
TV's Alan. You probably have heard about him because he has sort of punctured the public consciousness, but as this kind of like down market Timberlake alternative with a mustache kind of thing.
Yep.
And that's a horrible disservice to who he is and what he's capable of. His first album, which he wrote and recorded before any competent business person gave him any advice, was called Cherry Blue Skies. And there was a single from it that did pretty well called When I Get You Alone, which heavily samples Beethoven's Fifth.
Saturday Night Fever. Oh my god!
Cover of Beethoven's Fifth, but it is like great. It's technically you'd have to call it R&B, I think, because it's like vocal and it's that way. But like he's like the songs are only tangentially about romance. They're more about like his weird hangups and how he would rather play basketball than be with you. There are a bunch of times he forgets the lyrics to his own songs and they leave it in. The songs are all weird. And it's sort of this thing of a guy who is super talented and is like has one foot in the R&B boat and then the other foot is just flailing around in the air, like doing karate kicks. And the songs are so great.
I have to say, I knew nothing about him until you recommended him to me. I actually am a little fascinated with him. That When I Get You Alone song, I played that about 10 times in a row.
It's a catchy good. Song.
It's actually good.
I met him once. He was a great guy.
He sounds like he'd probably be a great guy. Is he a stoner?
He gives off that vibe.
I totally picked up that vibe. Received. And I'm going to recommend the one and only studio album that the Modern Lovers ever did.
Nice.
Just simply because I feel like they haven't gotten their due.
Sure.
And we've all been thinking, and this is not going to come out till the end of May, but we've all been thinking about Boston.
Yeah, big time.
Right? Jonathan Richman, two members that went on to be in The Cars and Talking Heads. Really great. And, you know, strong Velvet Underground influence and, you know, who doesn't appreciate that?
Definitely agree.
Right?
And then also there's a movement on to have Roadrunner be named the official rock song of Massachusetts.
I've heard that.
And now there's this whole counterinsurgency that wants Sweet Emotion. And you got to choose sides. I am an Aerosmith apologist, but that's not right. that's just not right.
So in other words, you're rooting for Roadrunner.
Yeah. Gotta be.
Okay. Yeah. That would make Boston, like, or Massachusetts, it's for the state song?
I think, state rock song.
State rock song. Yeah. That would make Massachusetts the coolest state in the union.
By far.
Modern Lovers.
It would just be, the race would be over.
Well, on that note, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome to get to do.
Yay.
Well, that was fun. We did it. We got through our first Louder Than Bombs podcast together. I just want to thank Matt Fisher again. He's an awesome friend for doing this and just a amazing guy. You can follow him on Twitter at Fisher Matt. That's his handle. And you can follow the Louder Than Bombs podcast at LTB_podcast. I know it's weird, but what can I tell you? There's a lot of Smiths fans out there that have Louder Than Bombs handles, so that's the best we could do. You can also join the Louder Than Bombs Facebook page. We would love to hear from you. Please post things, ask us questions, make suggestions. Anything goes, as long as it's not too kinky, all right? And that's it. Thanks to Mina Sajwani, my producer, Lauren Vassell, who did all the cool graphic design for everything Louder Than Bomb podcast related. And a huge thank you to Alex Gimeno, otherwise known as Ursula 1000, my evil twin, who did this amazing theme music. We're going to close with a little bit of that. And we have two more podcasts that we're posting today on our big day. And then we'll be back every other Wednesday. So please subscribe and let us hear from you. Bye.